said you can kill my body, but you know you can't mess with my mind.
Welcome to Economics and Beyond. I'm Rob Johnson, president of the Institute for New Economic Thinking.
Say you can kill my body.
Say you can kill my body.
But you know you can't mess with my mind.
Say no, you can't kill my mind.
You know we'll go away.
We're gonna go away.
Come back, come back, come back,
come back.
My second time.
I'm here today with Martin Wolf, the chief economics commentator for the Financial Times and a PhD economist and someone who's written many, many very interesting books and interesting columns. Martin, I'm delighted to be here with you today.
It's a pleasure. The only small correction I would make to what you said is that actually I have an MPhil in economics. I was too lazy to complete the thesis.
Well, I would say I would give you an honorary degree based on experience and the quality of what you've represented over the years. So I'm sorry about that error, but I guess the error reflects the esteem in which I hold you. We're right now amidst the pandemic. We're talking on the day when the President of the United States and his wife have appeared to been confirmed to have the COVID virus. You're working on a book that has all kinds of dimensions about the global system, its what you might call unsustainability, nature of governance, and so forth. But as you see this pandemic and the things that it's unmasked, what is it that, how would I say, you find most profound? What is it that you are haunted by? And what good things do you see happening, or what good things would you suggest we need to address?
So these are obviously huge questions. I think it's perhaps helpful to start by placing this in the context of my thinking, because this is obviously a huge shock, but it is in the context of developments that have occurred in the past, which are of immense importance. My book, Folk, is called, at least its a working title, is The Crisis of Democratic Capitalism. And it's about the breakdown of the, what one might call the system of the West. The West, the Western system in its modern incarnation, has essentially been this combination of some sort of market economy, which for shorthand we call capitalist, and democracy. That's been true at least since the Second World War. So quite a long period, and it was an aspiration for much longer. That's where we wanted to go. And 30 years or so ago, when the Soviet Union collapsed, that seemed a completely victorious system. Even if one wasn't as optimistic as Frank Fukuyama, it seemed this was the system that was running the world. And to put it mildly, things don't look like that anymore. So the book is about, focuses on what's gone wrong within the context of a world which outside the West is seeing, of course, and I think it's related to it, a huge rise in what I call demagogic autocracy. The Putins, Orbans, Erdogans, Modis of the world. And of course, of what I call bureaucratic autocracy or communist bureaucratic autocracy, which is China, a superpower with a very different system. So that's one colossal change. We are seeing the rise of enormous existential global challenges, most obviously environmental challenges. We have seen the marked instability and faltering performance of the market economy, the capitalist economy of the West, shown in long-term dysfunction over probably 30, 40 years up to 2007-8, and then this enormous financial crisis. And associated with that, and in my view, in large measure consequence on that, we've seen the rise of demagogic authoritarian politics in the core countries of the West, and notably the US. So that's, as it were, the background within which my analysis works, and of course within which we need to understand the impact of COVID-19. So what has COVID-19 done to us? Well, it was at first in itself, of course, a shock because it happened now, but not a surprise. We sort of knew that a pandemic was a very likely event. We've been told this many times. However, the reality is always different from the expectation, or rather the non-expectation. And what it's shown us, I suppose, is many countries, including some of the richest, most powerful countries in the world, have found it immensely difficult to manage this, manage it technically, administratively, and of course politically, and that's notably true of the US and UK, but also other countries. There's been a huge divergence in performance of countries in responding to this, and the major Western democracies have, on the whole, done pretty poorly compared with the East Asians, both the democratic societies and the autocratic ones, particularly China. That's a very striking feature. We found that COVID-19 has underlined and exacerbated the social, economic, gender, ethnic fault lines in our societies. Its burden has fallen immensely unequally on the people already most vulnerable, though that's a little bit complicated because the disease itself affects mostly the old, who are on the whole better off in many cases, but the economic effect has fallen very heavily on the young, so that reinforces something that was happened. And it's now put us in a position of radical uncertainty about our economic future. Are the effects we are seeing on the way we're organizing production, the way we are living, on the future of cities, are these permanent or temporary? And it's pretty clear that the governing systems we have, notably in the West, but also at the global level, to help the emerging countries, to help the developing countries, are really failing. They're doing much worse than they did even after 2008, and that was hardly a good period. So I would say that COVID-19 has underlined for me that the world, and particularly the part that is closest to me, my part of it, the Western world, whose core values I have historically throughout my life treasured, I believe in, very much on the Western side against the Soviets, believe in democracy, and I believe in some version of the markets, but our system is basically failing very profoundly. So to summarize this lengthy answer to a huge question, I think COVID-19 has shown us very, very starkly, very brutally, the depth of the social and the economic and political crisis we are now in.
Well, I sense, and I remember something you'd shared with me that you'd written recently, that you said that the success stories, here are the countries like Taiwan, Vietnam, New Zealand, were successful not because of a superior technology, but because of superior organization. And what concerns me right now, Martin, is that I think that despondency and despair fuel the breakdown of organization and perhaps make us more susceptible to authoritarian demagoguery. What when you talked about, or when you wrote about, superior organization, what are the ingredients? What do you see that we should be pointing toward to put us back onto the kind of trajectory where faith and trust in expertise, in governance, and in a healthy future for our children can be achieved?
I think the way I think about this now is sort of there's a virtuous spiral and a vicious spiral. And the deep question you're asking, I think, is how do you turn around a downturn, reverse course on a downward spiral when it's gone on for a long time? So somebody has made the point, which I think is a very good one, which is that what really these societies shared was trust. Trust in one another, trust in experts, trust in the administrative systems, and trust in the government. And they work together because of the mutual trust. In a society with strong mutual trust, a high trust society of that kind, people are not inclined to believe that everything they're asked to do is the product of a conspiracy. They're not inclined to believe in conspiracy theories at all because they trust experts. They trust authority because they think it's authoritative. The politicians play within that because they know if they start spouting wild and ludicrous nonsense, they will be laughed at. They will be regarded as ridiculous because it doesn't make any sense. This is sort of, if you like, the high trust equilibrium, which is obviously a very complex product of, in my view, fundamentally long-standing success. It builds out of success. You trust because what people have told you in the past has turned out to be true. And you feel that on the whole, with obviously always exceptions, there are reasons to trust people who are advising you to think certain things or do certain things, because on the whole, they've turned out to be pretty sensible. And I think if you look at New Zealand, this is a long-standing tradition of this country. The East Asian societies, I've just been writing about this, share a very deep, long-standing historical tradition, much older than ours, of belief in high-quality bureaucratic governance. It's an asset in which society ought to trust and which is, to some degree, trustworthy. So Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, China, Vietnam, all Singapore, all share that set of values. And by and large, not always, in recent times, their governments have shown themselves to be trustworthy in those senses. And it is worth stressing, though I disagree with so much of it, but it's horrifying to say this because of the terrible things they're doing in parts of their country. But, you know, the Chinese government has shown itself more determined to save the lives of the Chinese people than our governments have. And that's sort of incredible. Now, horrifying, I think. So that's the good spiral. Now, let's suppose you have a society where things have gone wrong for a lot of people over a long time. Nothing has been done to help them. Nothing effective. They don't really understand why, because they don't understand the details of the very complex systems they live in, but they know nothing has been done to help them. Their politicians have encouraged them to blame foreigners or ethnic minorities or elites. And sometimes the elites particularly are very blameworthy and can be easily targeted. Just look at what happened in the run-up to the financial crisis. Look at the way so many people have been feathering their nests so obviously and egregiously wrongly, I think. I think this much more now than I did 20 years ago. That's a fault of mine. So people are very, very cynical. They don't trust anybody. Even they trust the experts a bit more. They, I think, trust, as I understand it, Dr. Fauci more than they trust Donald Trump, but they don't really trust anybody. And there's conspiracy theories everywhere, corroding trust. This is a downward spiral. Now, I like to quote a remark by a man who's actually, I think he's rather repellent, but this is a very perceptive remark about what happens in these situations. And we saw it in the 30s in Europe. And the remark is from a British author about a century ago called G.K. Chesterton, very reactionary Catholic conservative. But he said, the problem when people lose their faith in God is not that they believe in nothing, but that they will believe in anything. So if people, and I think it's very apposite, if people lose their faith in their economic, social, political elites, in the people who are in charge, they won't suddenly say, okay, the right thing to do is believe in nobody, rely on our own wits and sort out for ourselves what's true. They will believe in anybody. They will believe in any plausible huckster who comes along with a simple lying saying it's all the fault of an elite conspiracy, the ethnic minorities you've always hated, foreigners, refugees. It's all their fault. If you give me all the power in the world, you trust me, give me all power, I'll sort it all out for you. I won't explain how, but that's what I will do. Plato wrote about this 2,500 years ago. And of course, we saw it so catastrophically in the 30s in Germany. And I think that's what's happened. So I don't know how you reverse the downward spiral when it's gone so far. Now, to stress, it seems to me that many Western countries are not in such a terrible shape. They're all, many of them have difficulties. But if you look at the Nordics, look at Germany, look at the Netherlands, look at many European countries, quite apart from East Asians I've talked about, there is still a lot of trust. Trust in institutions, trust in politicians, not as much as there might have been 30, 40 years ago, but there is trust. Clearly, Angela Merkel is hugely trusted in Germany. But unfortunately, in absolutely central countries of the West, and of course elsewhere, trust in institutions, trust in experts, trust in respectable business people, quote unquote, has gone. And you see it in America. You see it clearly in the Brexit debate in Britain. You see it, of course, in Brazil. And the results are, we are exactly where you say it, we are. Well, the last time this happened, the only way sane order was restored was a war in which the dictators lost. Well, we can't have such a war. And nobody would be there to fight it. So we have to save ourselves from it within. And to do that, we have to have political leaders who have, that's not me, alas, who have the charisma and the sense to take the podium away from the demagogues, start to build first-rate government, start to show they understand the problems and act cumulatively to rebuild trust. I think that's what FDR did, as far as I can see. I'm not an expert, but I've read a lot about it. And that's what we need. And it's unfortunately not so far what we're seeing.
As I was listening to you, I was reminded earlier this year, I read a book about the, what you might call, transfer of the religious instinct away from God and towards market-based institutions. A man named Eugene McCarraher wrote the book called The Enchantment of Mammon. But I came across a quote by a man from England. His name was R.C. Zahner at Oxford University. And he said very succinctly, loss of faith in a given religion does not by any means imply the eradication of the religious instinct. It merely means that the instinct, temporarily repressed, will seek an object elsewhere. And I think the attachment to what you might call flawed ideologies and institutions and so forth has accelerated as the evidence of what you might call the failure of representation has grown and grown and grown. And I think this challenge of the rebuilding of trust is a very, very difficult one. But I don't think there's an alternative pathway for the reasons you've just described.
Well, one thing that I've been thinking about quite a lot, again, I was too stupid to realize this 30, 40 years ago. But it is possible, I think it is probable that fascism and communism helped us enormously. Because they were clearly the most important examples of failed secular religions of the 20th century. I think we can all agree they were failed on all counts, and they were monstrous. And that forced our leaders in the past, towards a relatively pragmatic and socially coherent way of presenting the balance between politics and economics in free societies. So I'm thinking in my book that a market democracy is a balance between the legitimate role for market institutions and market actions within the context of a legitimate constraining, morally acceptable politics. And in the middle of the 20th century, every society, in different ways, depending on the history and so forth, that survived and was recreated after the war, tried to create exactly that. And then as the fascism was defeated, thank heavens, and communism started to degrade and collapse, care about this disappeared. People suddenly started thinking, well, we've won, we can do anything. Let it rip. Capitalism won. Let's let it rip. Don't worry about the consequences. None of that is going to be serious. And it took really remarkably little time, 25, 30 years, before by investing too much in the belief in markets, market institutions, laissez-faire, whatever you call it, it started completely unbalancing society and politics and corrupting politics. And as it corrupted politics, it disillusioned people more. And then they started, when they looked at the system, then they see the market economy run amok. They see politics corrupted. And then the faith is gone. They want it completely. They want a new faith. And as I said earlier, when there's no institutionalized ideology that makes sense to believe in, we no longer believe in communism. We no longer believe in fascism. We don't believe in the institutions of the market and democracy. There is, in the end, only one thing left. And it is the oldest thing in human history. And it is the charismatic demagogue. And if all else fails, that's where human beings go. And that, I think, is the danger. And it's what we're seeing all over the world. And part of that, as I'm suggesting, I think, and building on what you said, is that we who had this idea, which I've certainly always believed in, but I've not been as clear as I should have been in how it might be made to work, in this balance of freedom between social institutions, political institutions, and economic institutions, an incredibly complicated and sophisticated thing which has to change all the time, that once you lose that balance and betray so many people, you end up with variations of civil war, which is what we're clearly seeing in the run-up to the election. It looks to an outsider like a civil war. And in your civil war, you end up asking, who's the leader who's going to fight for you? And that, I think, is what's happened. But I do think this end of ideology is a very important part of this. We have gone through all the ideologies. And one of the, there is one good thing about it, and only one good thing, which is in the mid-20th century, the ideologies were so passionately believed in that people who were marching under those banners were perfectly prepared to kill hundreds of millions of people. You know, if you add the Nazis to the communists, probably something like 150 million people died. Nobody knows exactly, but unbelievable numbers because of this ideological enthusiasm. That's gone. Our current leaders, even the Chinese leader, but certainly the demagogic autocrats I'm talking about, they're gangsters, they're crooks. They run kleptocratic regimes. They're completely cynical. Their supporters are basically completely cynical when they're not just angry. But their ambitions are, by the standards I've just described, small-time ambitions. Their ambitions to make their family rich, to run a squalid little regime in which nobody criticizes them, in which they can do whatever they like. So we have got, in that sense, with these people to the end of ideology. And it has this one upside. The downside, of course, is, as we've discussed, how do you rescue hope and belief, which is necessary for any sophisticated society, from regimes whose coin is distrust, is denigration, is hostility, is vulgarity, is corruption. If that's the regime, what can you possibly believe in?
Well, as I was listening to you, I was reminded of a seminar that I attended when I was a graduate student at Princeton University, where the European historian Arno Mayer, who wrote a book called Wilson versus Lenin, was in conversation with Sheldon Wolin, whose book Democracy Incorporated is about some of the deteriorations in recent years that you've alluded to. What Mayer said was kind of a challenge to the audience. He said, take out your globe and a string. And what I would say to you is the places on Earth where the compensation of labor is highest in relation to productivity can be measured by the distance of the string from the border of the Soviet Union. I mean, what he was insinuating was that Western regimes were willing to pay an insurance premium against rebellion and switch to communism by compensating labor. And the closer you were, Scandinavia, Germany, parts of Eastern Europe, Japan, the closer you were to Soviet border, the more likely the system would mobilize to protect itself from that regime switch. And in the aftermath of the collapse of communism, there was no longer a need to pay for that insurance because there was no regime switching potential in the offing.
Yeah, I think that's a very intriguing view. I haven't tried to do this empirically, but I think it's a very, very important part of the history of Europe. And I think one of the reasons, there are other reasons for the extent to which the US and Europe, including here even the UK, have diverged. And in the end, the UK is much more like a European country than it is like the US, which is, of course, sui generis. I'm sure one of the reasons is that the risk of a serious swing left was far greater in in Europe than in America. I would say, though, I haven't looked at the figures, but my before 1980, so just to quibble a little, France and Italy were relatively unequal societies, France particularly so, and yet these were the countries with the biggest communist parties, which would suggest they had the highest probability of shifting towards communism. So I'm not sure it works perfectly, but it's a beautiful idea. And it does underline something very, very depressing, which is this idea that there are sort of two things that come out of the literature, I think, on this, about what makes societies concerned for the welfare of all their population. And I think the evidence on these two things is reasonably clear. One is exactly, is there a credible political alternative which has force, which you have to respond to, if you like, the communism stroke fascism one. More communism, I think, for more period in the 20th century than the fascism, or at least some version of socialism. And the other one, I'm afraid, is ethnic diversity. The more diverse a society is ethnically, it seems, the more difficult it is to mobilize what one might call the working class, the relative losers, the workers, in a single campaign to get them treated properly. The easier it is to pursue what I have referred to, not very originally in my book, as the Southern strategy, by which I mean an elite strategy to split what we in Europe would call the working class, whatever you want to call it, on ethnic lines. And that's the second thing. So given those two factors, the lack of an alternative ideology that looks plausible and increasing ethnic diversity, which is being exploited, is obviously being exploited, it becomes much more difficult to imagine how you get out of this. And it's much easier to see how demagogues can play to ethnic tensions as part of their plan to seize power with the support of plutocrats whose main aim is simply to create a coalition which will keep their taxes low and protect their property. And that's what I call the cynical coalition. The cynical coalition clearly works politically horrifyingly well. It's what gave us Brexit. It's what gave you Trump. And the big difficulty with my book is I know where I would like to go. You know, I have an idea what a better society might look like. Many people disagree with this idea, but I think it's a reasonably sensible one. It models a very substantial revival of democracy and a reform of capitalism. But I have no idea how you get there. What sort of politics could emerge that would allow you to get there? And it's obviously disappointing, it's a long answer in this regard, that in Britain, the proposals came from the Corbyn side and they were completely unacceptable to the public for whatever reason. And I think many of them were unacceptable. And what were generally really very modest proposals, I put aside some aspects of them, from the left in America on universal healthcare, Medicare for all, wealth taxes, inheritance taxes, proved unacceptable to the Democratic primary voters. And so what you have is a campaign now between obviously someone I regard as a dangerous lunatic and a sane human being, but still not somebody who's going to fix the flaws of America at all, even if gets a landslide, and therefore we'll be back again, I think, 4-8 years from now where we are now, even if Biden should win. So this is the despair is of how you make the politics work.
I think a lot of the things that you're talking about resonate with some of the research that I've seen through iNet. I know you're familiar with The Vanishing Middle Class by Peter Timman. And I've done even research myself growing up in Detroit on the relationship between what I'll call the geography of economic distress and the locus of racial animosity. And what I guess I'm alluding to here is in places where economic dislocation is profound and what you might call surveys or whatever of despair about economic conditions are acute, are highly correlated with where racial animosity, what John Paul, one of my iNet board members who's also from Detroit, refers to as otherness. Otherness comes to divide people. And as you were talking about Scandinavia or Japan or places like that that are more ethnically homogeneous, it's harder to other. But what Timman talks about in his book is that when otherness takes hold, that people will actually vote against their own self-interest. And in this case, rather than Arthur Lewis's model of walking from the farm to the factory, the transition from low-margin services to high-margin services requires you go through the education system. And while, how would I say, 70% of the American population is really working in these low-margin areas, they're tolerating or even endorsing the destruction of a broad-based public education system, including retraining junior colleges and all these other things, but starting from pre-K and all, because they don't want to give those others an advance or money or opportunity because they think of them as parasites or predators because they've been conditioned by this otherness. And as you said, cynical plutocrats, not everybody who's wealthy is a hideous person, but cynical plutocrats can say, why don't you and him go fight with each other and leave me alone to take all the treasure?
Well, the reason I call it the Southern Strategy is, though, of course, it's the Southern Strategy of the modern Republican Party. It's basically how they became at least close to being a majority party. There was no other way for them. To foster this. But I was really referring to what I have come to think is one of the most fascinating political and social phenomena in world history, which is your civil war, because it's so beautiful, which is the southern states were essentially run by the plantocracy, very small proportion of the population. I only discovered relatively recently, but you know the work probably much better than I do, so it's new to me, that the southern plantocracy was much richer at that time than the northern business elite. They were the richest people in America. They owned essentially all the slaves. And they wished to preserve what Piketty has shown was just simply enormous wealth, which was contained in their ownership of people. And how did they do that when the North wanted to end slavery? Well, they had to mobilize their communities, and they'd already built this up over the previous centuries to fight and die for them. And what is so astonishing is they got the entire Southern white population to do this, most of whom had no slaves or really no prospect of substantial wealth from this. They were substantially poorer, poor white trash, I believe they've been called, than Northerners. But the death rate of the Southern whites in the war, overwhelmingly, as I said, poor whites, and was staggering. I mean, as many Southerners died in the war as Northerners, despite their vastly inferior numbers. And I mean, you can't do much that is worse for your economic interest than get killed in a battle. So it's pretty clear that you can mobilize people. Why did they do this? Because they thought they were fighting for home, and they were fighting against a world in which the blacks might be equal to them, which was unthinkable, inconceivable, unbearable. So it was a race war. And it's the purest example I can think of in history, there may be others, in which this element we've been discussing drove people to essentially to suicidal decisions and suicidal motivations. Now, I've discussed in a chapter of mine how you might try and get around this, and the answer is to generate a credible, inclusive patriotism. A patriotism in which people genuinely believe that what they share institutionally, socially, in value terms is far greater than what divides them. And I do think, despite many flaws, as a politician, Obama has tried to articulate this. But it now seems to me, looking at America and also here, that with the development and rise to my mind, from this point of view, politically destructive, or at least in substantial measure destructive identity politics of the left, matching the obviously destructive identity politics of the right, the possibility of forging a sense that we are all united and an essential element of this unification is our shared responsibility to ensure everybody has opportunity, everybody has security, everybody has the possibility of a decent life. That fundamental core idea that is essential to democratic capitalism, to a stable democracy, that idea has become impossible. And the interaction between the left and the right, if it continues on this essentially identity lines, rather than the way I'm trying to articulate and obviously unsuccessfully just now, I just feel that this has become a hopeless struggle. Somebody has to do this. It is worth noting, of course, you know this much better than I do, that for all his many successes, FDR could only do what he did by allowing the Dixiecrats to continue to run the South in the way they did, and allowing, as a result, enormous inherited and entrenched injustices for blacks to continue for 30 more years. And of course, that couldn't and shouldn't have been allowed to last. But actually, by the way, find a little footnote, even in Scandinavia, where society has become much more diverse than it used to be, because immigration has been so large and so quick, and I think that they are having some problems in maintaining that sense of cohesion. And it's one of the great challenges of modern diverse societies. I'm not blaming here immigrants or immigration, but it's clear that we have an even bigger challenge than we did 30, 40 years ago, along with all the other challenges, in building this notion of a shared commonwealth, which is what I believe is an essential ingredient for a stable democracy.
This is the end of part one of my conversation with Martin Wolf about his forthcoming book on the relationship between capitalism and governance through time and into the future. Please join me for part two coming shortly.
And check out more from the Institute for New Economic Thinking at ineteconomics.org.
And I'll tell it and speak it and think it and breathe it. And reflect from the mountain so all souls can see it. And I'll stand on the ocean until I start sinking. But I'll know my song well before I start singing.